Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in radio, Ronald J. Martin. Baby, just you and me today.
Baby, I'm here. I'm here for it.
We're limping along on this program, man. With all the summer travel and just the important, glamorous people that we have on this program who are in demand all over the world. It's hard to get us all in the studio at the same time, but yet here we are. Here we are doing radio for the people, baby. Is it lucrative for us? Not really. It used to be. Then we made some changes, and now it's less lucrative. But baby, nevertheless, here we are doing some radio on a Wednesday morning, and I'm going to take a break for the super lucrative ad break. All right, you're going to hear about, I don't know, Home Depot or Arby's or any number of things, and we'll be right back.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with the King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
All right, baby, we're back. Full disclosure, I want to be honest with the people.
Yeah,
okay?
Absolutely.
We have not thought for one second about what to talk about. But I have a new thing that I'm watching that I want to run by you. I want to see if you've watched it. We're watching this food kind of documentary, docuseries on Netflix. Jon Favreau's involved in it. It's called The Chef Show.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Chef Show?
I have.
It's fun, dude.
Yeah, it's fun. Who's kind of his main sidekick? Is it David Chang? Main sidekick?
No, it's not David Chang.
No? Okay.
Yeah, but I knew who you were talking about, and it's fun, and they kind of meet up with celebrities / celebrity chefs, make recipes. And it's... So I loved the movie Chef. Let's start there. Where were you at on the movie Chef?
I mean, it was a... It's obviously a late period Favreau piece, you know, because he doesn't really act anymore. I kind of dug the premise. It was a little too depresso for me, you know, given his life, but it was kind of one of those movies that didn't make me feel good, you know, because his life felt depressing. But
dude, stop there. Actually, you found Chef to be depresso.
Well, just because, you know, the relationship, wasn't his relationships all fractured and falling apart?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, he was separated or divorced from the, you know, the lady, and then, you know, he had got to see his kid once in a while or whatever.
Yeah, so that kind of put that just was like, oh, he's one of these guys and he's just kind of running after something, and it's...
Yes.
So for that, I don't know, I mean,
he's essentially what we would be without Christ, yeah. Probably, personality-wise.
Basically, you know? Yeah. So, I don't know. That put kind of a bit of a Debbie on it for me. But then... I thought he's super convincing as a chef, though, isn't he?
Yeah. So, he got super into the food thing for that movie, and apparently is, like, in real life, really passionate about it.
Yeah.
And was passionate about wanting to make the kitchen scene's authentic and wanting to do it well, and you know, then just sort of acquired a love for it in real life. And I loved it. I thought it's on my Mount Rushmore of food movies for sure. Do you have a food movie Rushmore? Do you have like go-to food movies?
Oh man, yeah, I love food movies. I love food movies. Not as much as sports movies, Ob. But I do love food. I mean, you know, I mean, not to be a little too basic here, but I loved Julie and Julia. You know, back when that came out 15 years ago, whenever that was, a while ago. But
dude, that's a fun time.
I loved that movie. Yeah, I love stuff like that. I'm trying refresh my memory about some food movies. What do you got,
dude? Okay, so I'll talk you through my food movie Rushmore. Okay. I don't have written down, and I'll be doing from memory. But Julie and Julia is a fun time, dude. That was like early career Amy Adams.
Yeah, 100%.
That was before she started doing like only weird arty stuff.
Yeah,
and she was still kind of doing fun movies. That was a really good role for her. Yeah, we enjoyed it. That had a little bit of France in it, which we love. So it kind of works as a travel movie and a food movie. I have one weird thing on that movie, and I want to know if you noticed it, and then I'll move on to some others. Her boyfriend in that film, and I forget the actor's name. He's like a movie that guy. He chewed with his mouth open for the duration of the movie.
It's so true.
And dude, it drove us absolutely insane. It was disgusting. And in fact, whenever we see him in a movie now, we call him the masticator. Because he just masticates with his mouth open. It's disgusting.
Yeah, I think it's so funny you say that, T. I remember that. And I remember thinking, oh, they're just trying to show, like, you know, they're just throwing food, you know, in their mouth. And yes. They're trying to keep it, like, really casual and loose. Like, how it would be if your girlfriend, wife, whatever she was cooking this amazing food and you were just blown away by it. I think they're trying to keep it real. But, yeah, it was really interesting, huh?
Dude, I have another weird thing in that movie. So that movie kind of did the New York apartment thing,
but they
tried real hard not to glamorize it, right? So they were out in, like, you know, the seventh level of, like, Queens in some very non-sexy apartment. Did you ever, like, even for a minute in your 20s, entertain the maybe we should live in New York thing? Did you ever have that minute of, like, fantasizing in your life?
You know what's weird? Like, there would be... When I was out on the road, because I was out on the road a lot in my 20s, you know, my early 20s to my mid-30s, the majority of that road time. And so, yeah, whenever we would play in a city and we would, you know, sometimes we would visit a friend who had an apartment, you know, downtown.
Yeah.
And there would be an appeal, because what I liked about it was that they lived their whole life within a few blocks and they had sort of this community and they could walk to things. And so if you live the suburban life, like you drive everywhere, you don't live that life. So that was kind of romantic to me. But I'll tell you, I mean, not to pivot too hard on this, but the life that always was just fascinating to me is the life that I eventually got to, which was small town life. That just absolutely fascinated me. And so I eventually got to do that. But I'll say this, dude, like I would say within the last like maybe 10 years, as I've spent more time in cities like that, there's a part of that that feels really appealing to me. I got to be honest.
Yeah, no, we've always, KK and I have always talked about empty nesting in a city.
Really?
Like, yeah.
Relocating down the road?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. And dude, I love the house I'm in now and I love the community I'm in now. And realistically, I wouldn't leave it. Like, I would be an idiot to leave the church that I'm in now. And so this won't happen. But like... Even just for a season or for like a sabbatical, like doing some empty nest time in a city, I think would be dope. Because we have the same feelings. Like whenever we travel to a big city, we're always like, oh, we could, especially without kids, like we could do this and we could really have some fun with it and, you know, enjoy that aspect of life. But
is there like a city section to where you're living that you could like do that in even locally?
No, I mean, our town is like...
It's kind of small town, right? Or no?
Yeah, so we live in Humboldt, which is legitimately a small town.
Oh, okay.
So, like, way smaller than Ashland.
Is it really called Humboldt? That's amazing.
It's called Humboldt. H-U-M-V-O-L-T.
You were saying it's called Humboldt. I'm like, wow, that's really saying something about yourself, you know?
Yeah, it really is. But no, we're in Humboldt, and then, yeah, like, I have like a... 12-minute commute to Jackson, which is where the university is. And Jackson, I would say, is a smidge bigger than Ashland, but not that much. It sort of, like, wants to think of itself as a city, and we have, like, just enough insufferable hipster population downtown to, like... They're constantly, like, trying to bring in city stuff and make it work, but it's not... It wouldn't work for, like, engaging that fantasy. You know, gotcha. I'd have to move.
Okay.
As far as doing it close by, it would have to be Memphis, because I just wouldn't do the Nashville thing. I low-key hate Nashville. But out Nashville.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm not allowed to like Nashville because growing up in sort of the subversive music scenes, I was in Nashville was the enemy. So
yeah,
it was the thing to avoid. And you know, because there is a vibe to Nashville. Like all the people.
There's definitely
a vibe. Well, I mean, even the people that think they're hipsters and cool in Nashville, they have sort of this veneer to them where you just kind of go, okay.
Yeah.
I know. Now I'm broad brushing everything now, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, we're broad brushing. We're offending all of our audience, 100%. Many of whom live in Nashville.
But you know, Nashville's great though. Great place.
Nashville's great place. Oh, Nashville's amazing. Nashville's it's a good food town. I will give it.
It's
that.
A fun and, town. I mean, I think it's a super fun town to go hang out. I mean, I dig it. I dig it a lot. You know.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's get back to our Rushmore food movies.
Yeah, throw it out
there. I want to talk more about Chef. We'll get back to it. But next on the Rushmore for me is a movie that you would love, dude.
Okay.
And maybe you've seen it. It's called The Big Night. Have you seen The Big Night?
Oh, yeah. We'll describe it real quick.
Dude, so it probably came out in the early 90s, and I think, without looking, and again, we had no idea what we were talking about going into this program, it's young Stanley Tucci and somebody else. And the premise is they have this struggling like Italian restaurant. And
oh, I have seen it. Yes, I have. I love it. The name didn't like register with me. Totally have seen it.
Yeah. So like, yeah. Young Tucci is in it. Minnie Driver's in it. Ian Holm from Chariots of Fire is in it. It's awesome, dude. And Tony Shalhoub, who was in that TV show from the 90s. And it's this lush Italian food movie where they make this big meal because someone under false pretenses has told them that like the Frank Sinatra figure of the world of the movie is going to be there. And that's going to like revive their business when they get all the media of this Sinatra-esque character being there. Yeah, so they make this like massive lavish meal and they end up essentially just serving it to their friends because of course the guy never shows.
That's right. The main guy that they're going through all this trouble with doesn't end up showing up.
Yeah. Yes. The main guy doesn't end up showing, but they make this big lavish lush meal. And it's kind of this commentary on like, you know, food brings people together and food for food's sake is worth it. And they're craftsmen and they do this amazing work. And even if like the world at large doesn't celebrate it, like it's still worth celebrating. And it's such a fun movie.
Baby, my favorite part, can I tell you? My favorite scene is
And then I have a favorite part.
My favorite scene is at the very end after they have the big night and they both wake up. And you could tell they're burnt out, they're tired, they're feeling a little depressed, it was overwhelming, the dude never showed up, and he just very quietly like scrambles up some eggs, they grab a big loaf of bread, and they just sit there and eat their eggs. Like the most simple thing, they created this elaborate meal, and they're just enjoying like the most simple breakfast, eggs and bread, in the morning, just kind of looking at each other, and that's how they finished up the film, if I remember correctly.
Gosh dang it, dude. That's my favorite scene too. And I love it because it has that like, I'm sure you got this way after shows and I got this way like after football games where like you're so spent and you've just like emptied yourself.
Yep.
And you've got nothing left and like whoever you're with, you just kind of take in that moment together and whatever there is to eat, like you enjoy it, you savor it. And that was the vibe. And actually that scene... So they actually made an omelet, and I watched that film again. I think I watched it for a second time, like during COVID, and I had nothing but time, of course. So I did like a summer of omelets.
Yeah,
where I started like oiling the pan before the omelet.
Oh yeah,
and salting the pan like they did in that movie.
Yeah.
So they would put down a layer of oil, then they would salt the pan, and then they would make this really simple omelet with like kind of a golden brown shell and a really chewy interior. And it just delighted me to make these omelets, dude.
So epic.
And
I
love that movie. I love the movie, The Big Night.
It's a great movie.
Definitely.
I got to watch it again. You inspired me. I'm going to watch it again. It's been a long time.
Dude, I'm going to watch it again too.
Great summer movie.
It's a great summer movie. Cause they're, I don't know where they even are. I don't even know if they say it, but I think they're on like the Jersey Shore or somewhere. In like the late 1940s, early 1950s, there's a bunch of 90s people in the movie. like very quintessentially 90s people. It's a fun watch, dude, for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
So Chef is a Rushmore food movie for me. Let's talk about Chef. I want to talk about some of the things I love about it. I love his chef's knife tattoo on his forearm. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a fun time. Dude, I love the sidekick figure. So the Leguizamo figure, and then the tall Italian guy who plays the sous chef. He's in everything too. He's a that guy. I gotta pull up the cast so I know what I'm talking about here. But I love those guys. I love their banter. I think they could have worked Vince Vaughn into the movie for a minute. I think that would have been a nice time.
Yeah, that would have been. I would have loved if you would have done that,
dude. I love the Robert Downey Jr. scenes. He's in the movie for like 5 minutes. He's the guy that gives Favreau the food truck.
Yeah,
and he plays kind of like the confident douche, and you know he's successful.
You mean Robert Downey Jr. in every movie he's ever played? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, he's great at that though. But he's let's go granular on this for a second. He's a different kind of confident douche than Vince Vaughn. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know what you're. I know what you're driving at. Yeah, they're completely. Vaughn is like he's not. I don't even know if I've described him like that. Even though I don't disagree with how you described him, right? Because he's not. Vaughn is not like Vaughn was not star quarterback. That's how you look at Robert Downey Jr. You know, like he's that guy, right?
He's the prom king.
He's the prom king. Yeah. That was not Vaughn. Vaughn was more of like the comedy guy that was good looking enough for a lot of the ladies to like. You know.
Yeah, for sure, dude. I got another one for you from Chef. I love the dynamic between Dustin Hoffman's character, who's the owner of the restaurant,
right,
and Favreau.
Yeah.
Because it's very emblematic of this like artist patron relationship. So whether you make a record with a record label or you write a book for a book publisher, there's always this dynamic of like they own the product, so ultimately they get to call the shots, but like you have a better vision of what it is that you want to do. And again, he was probably only on screen for less than 10 minutes, but I feel like his scenes really popped.
Yeah. I forgot about his character, man. It was such a weird role for him in some ways because it was so small, but.
Dude, were you out on Dustin Hoffman?
Yeah, I'm a fan.
I love him.
Yeah, I love him too.
I loved him in that. I loved him in Stranger Than Fiction, kind of playing the college professor version of the same character.
Yeah, he's a
really fun actor. What was your favorite food moment in Chef?
What I love about any cooking show is if they kind of drop down into some actual cooking. And I think with Fav, he had enough of those moments where he was frantic. I loved it when he was frantically trying to do these dishes to kind of gain back his confidence and get his rhythm back, and all that kind of stuff. And so, I loved it when they would actually show him in the kitchen starting to like, mix things and unpack things and put things together. There's just something, what I love about food movies or food shows in general is that it's easy watching. You can have a dialogue with the person you're watching with because there's nothing going on. There's not a lot of dialogue.
Yeah, sure.
And I love that it just inspires me to want to eat. And I know that sounds crazy, but like, I like that.
Yeah.
I
like that too.
I like kind of like I love sort of like gaining an appetite, working up an appetite by watching a food movie is awesome to me. You know?
Well, yeah, it is, dude. And it always delivers. So let's do this. Actually, I want to talk about a Last Chef thing. I want to talk about my favorite food moment in Chef. And there were many. Then we'll take a break and then we'll do the fourth movie on my food Rushmore. My favorite food moment, dude, was after everything kind of comes crumbling down and they get the bad review and he goes after the reviewer in the restaurant. What did you think of that, dude? Because so you came up doing records back when reviews probably mattered, and I came up doing books. I caught like the last gasp of like traditional book publishing where like you would get reviewed in papers.
Right.
And like the the publicist would send you like a envelope full of review clippings, like in hard copy form.
Yeah, they didn't all just exist on Amazon, right?
Yeah, they didn't all just exist on Amazon. So it was like the real book publishing industry and the real record industry for you. What was your relationship with critics? And did it resonate with you when Favs like went after the critic in the restaurant scene?
You know, I always think that you got to play it a little cool with that. I'm not saying I always did. I remember there was only one time it was, I think it was the first review, one of the first reviews I ever got. And it just, it, this guy just, he was a pretty important, you know, critic, and he tanked my record. And I think it actually deserved it, right? But it was the way he did it that I didn't like. So I actually contacted him. I said, man, I just don't think you needed to. I didn't think he needed to have that tone. I wish I wouldn't have done it. And we since made up and apologized. He's a great guy. And, but I think I caught myself, doing that, and I never did it again. And so I just embraced it, but I just didn't want to be the guy that was like, how dare you not like my work? Because it's hypocritical, right? Because there's a ton of work I don't like that I'll be real honest about. And so I just switched it in my mind to say, hey, you know, because also logically, like the reviews don't really matter. Like it doesn't.
No.
People that like your stuff like your stuff. They're not really. I don't know. That's right. You know. I mean, I've had a. I don't know. You tell me this. I have read some reviews on things that I hadn't yet embraced, and had thought about, and reading about it made me want to check it out. So that like a review has worked for me. But I will say this: a negative review has rarely impacted me.
So, yeah, it's rarely like put you off of a thing that you thought you wanted to consume anyway.
To be honest, man, it might have the opposite effect. When something gets tanked that bad, it actually piques my interest at that point. Like I'm like, oh shoot, man, I don't know. Like I want to hear this thing. I'm like, this guy hated it. I'm really curious. You know?
Yeah, and the movie sort of leaned into the last gasp of reviewers mattering, right? Before Amazon just took over and before reviews were just noise, or before reviews were just fake curated things that you ask all your friends for and they don't matter. So the Oliver Platt character was sort of a hat tip to Jonathan Gold, who's like the greatest food reviewer of all time and really a good writer. So if they were really going to homage Jonathan Gold, they didn't capture the good writing. But I guess I like the dynamic of Favs going at him on that level of, you know, I work hard to make something I create, and all you do is crap all over.
All
you do is vomit all over things that people make. And that's fair. Especially like the young version of me, the young, like, I don't really know how the industry works and I'm just governed by my feelings version of myself. I definitely felt that way about critics. Like, what do you do? You know, what have you ever made?
Right.
And so probably there's still some of that energy in there for me. So I find that scene where he confronts him, like they play it for comedy and it's over the top and it's ridiculous, but it's still kind of a fun time. Let's take a break, baby.
I'm going to say one more thing on when we come back.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
I think that there's a kind of critic out there that deserves to be critiqued. You know what I'm saying? Yes. Like, so yeah. I think there's moments where I think that can be fair. I'm remembering that reviewer on Chef, and he was just sort of inadvertently, he just kind of gave everything a bad review, was Favreau's kind of opinion of him. So a true critic, I mean, if you read a review from somebody who is known as being like a really good reviewer, I mean, they're always, they're going to give their opinion on things they don't care for. They're also going to say, but this was actually really good, or this is a really strong point. I just wish they would have maybe leaned into this a little bit more or accentuated this a little bit more. Like, I think a fair review will contain like, you know, all the different elements, you know?
You're absolutely right. And I think Jonathan Gold got there. I taught some Jonathan Gold this semester in an opinion writing class, and I really enjoyed reading his stuff. And it was clear to me, two things were foundational in his reviews. One, he loved food. Like, he really loved food more than he loved, I don't know, being clever or crapping all over somebody's work or whatever. But he also loved writing. So, like, he loved the craft of writing, and he really loved food. And I think those two things, whether he was reviewing, like, I don't know, some hotel bar in Chicago or some, you know, super effete hipster place in Brooklyn or whatever, like, he kind of captured the spirit of places. And, yeah, to your great point, I think there are multiple categories of reviewers, right? Yeah. And there are some that are just slash and burn guys, and then there are some that really care about the craft, and those are the ones that you want to listen to. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about my favorite food scene and chef, and then we'll talk Mount Rushmore food movies right after this quick break.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, baby. After it all goes down, after he gets fired, so Carl Casper gets fired, he comes home, he's with the Scarlett Johansson character, which is a little crazy to me. I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but he's with Scarlett Johansson, and it's late at night, and he just makes her this very simple pasta dish, and then he plates it in a very specific way. That scene always drives me crazy with, like, wanting that dish. They make it look so good. I love Fav's apartment in the movie. I don't know if you have Fav's apartment thoughts.
Yeah, but
it's like real.
I'm trying to remember.
Kind of industrial. Kind of so, like, the way the apartment's laid out, you come in and it's like supposed to be sad divorced guy's apartment, but it looks kind of cool. Like, there's a weight bench, like, where the living room should be. There's like a futon. And the whole thing is basically like an industrial kitchen,
yeah,
right? So there's like this big kitchen, and it's all super functional, function over form. And he just makes her this amazing pasta dish in the middle of the night. And I like that vibe. I like the vibe of like food for food's sake. It doesn't have to be time for a meal. We're just doing this
that's
now,
right.
And I'm going to make it amazing for you.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
Yeah, and we're going to enjoy it together. I don't know. That scene just... like does some things for me. Your thoughts?
I think he captures, this is what I would say, man. He captures sort of the heart behind sort of a non-snobby foodie culture, which is just,
ooh, good.
You know what I'm saying?
That's
which is
good.
Just, hey, dude, like there's a way to cook food right. And there's a way to use the right ingredients to do it in a way that's going to make it most delicious. But we also don't got to be uppity about it. Like, let's have a good time with it. Let's keep that part of it lowbrow, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, that's huge, dude. And that actually is the perfect transition to the fourth movie on my food, Rushmore. I want to know if you've seen this. And if you haven't, I really want you to view it. And it's either on Netflix or HBO Max. It's on one of the two. It's called The Menu.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Menu?
I have heard that name, but I don't think I've seen it.
Okay, so it's brand new. Came out in 2022. It's billed as a horror comedy, but it's really more like a psychological, make you think, but not make you think on a like a who did it level, but make you think on a implications of things level.
Okay.
I thought it was amazing. It stars Ralph Fiennes as like a celebrity chef. So in the world building of the movie, he's like the most world-renowned chef that there is. Mm. And he's become so famous that in order to eat his meals, it's like a several thousand dollars experience where you like take a boat out to like this deserted island where he lives and where his restaurant is, and it's this immersive experience.
Okay, so right? It's uppity, yeah.
It's uppity, but in the world of the movie, he's become disgusted with that, right?
Oh, so okay.
He's basically become so famous and so successful that he's priced himself into a category where he now hates all the people who consume his food. So, like, if you're able to afford that kind of a dining experience, you're either so rich as to be disconnected from the reality of life itself, or you're one of these super effete, smug, like food snob, aesthetic people, and you're insufferable. So essentially what happens, and I'm going to give spoilers here, but you sort of see this coming and it's not the point of the movie. He gets all these people out for a food experience and decides he wants to kill all of them, but himself, right? But he wants to kill all of them in a way that sort of exposes their besetting sins.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating movie.
That's funny.
It has the girl from The Queen's Gambit in it, Anya Taylor-Joy.
Okay.
I don't know if you watched The Queen's Gambit chess thing. Did you watch it?
Couldn't get into it. I tried, yeah.
Dude, I got into it, but only for the aesthetics. I thought every hotel room was the best hotel room I had ever seen.
Well, man, that makes me want to go see it now again.
You should see it for that. View it through that lens. I don't know, and let me know if you have thoughts.
Okay.
But anyway, this thing, The Menu, KK and I watched it kind of on the whim because we were like, oh, new food movie. We'll check it out. And it drew us in. It was delightful. It was dark. It was kind of sick and twisted, but not in, like, it wasn't gross out.
Is it a
right?
Movie or
it wasn't
series?
About. It's a movie. It's okay. A one-off, like, hour and 45-minute thing. I don't think a lot of people have seen it.
Yeah, it didn't go big.
It's the kind of thing that doesn't get a big billing. Leguizamo's in it. Leguizamo's great in it. It's just a really fun, thoughtful. I thought it said some things, and I'd be interested to hear you on this both now and after you view the movie. I thought it said some interesting things about creative control.
Huh.
And here's why.
Okay.
I have always sort of placed creative control on a high pedestal, i.e. I've probably idolized it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So especially again, as in like the young version of myself as a writer, I was always like, oh, creative control. I gotta have creative control. And I always positioned that as like the thing that would make me happy. But again, in the world building of the movie, his character has all the creative control he could ever want or need. And he has all the budget he could ever want or need. But he's miserable, right?
Okay.
So this is really like, again, viewing it through the Christian worldview, apart from Christ, you're going to be miserable, right? So all the money in the world, all the creative control
all
in the world.
All
the money, baby. All the creative control. Like, you're still going to be miserable, right? And I thought, watching it at 47, I was like, I wish the 27-year-old version of myself could have seen this,
yeah,
you know? Because
yeah.
I think it would have helped me understand some things about, I don't know, the idolatrous relationship that I had with creative control. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's funny because it's like, you know, all the money, all the creative control without Christ doesn't make you happy. It's just too bad we don't actually believe that's true. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so we, there's a part of us that goes, we know spiritually and we even know intellectually because our minds have been changed and formed by Christ that that's true. But there's also a part of us that, like, in our own way, we're always like, we're leaning into that pretty hard, you know, at our own level, in our own ways. But
but
I do think that's like, I think too, as believers, like, we detect that really quickly when we see that.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because that becomes our commentary for it when we're watching it,
mm-hmm.
which is like, mm-hmm. man, you're putting all of your eggs in this particular basket, but it's like a rotten basket. It's a basket that's going to collapse, you know, under its own weight. And and so we detect that really quickly, and it becomes our commentary when we watch things. And yet, like, I mean, we just struggle with it just as much as they do, don't we? You know what I mean?
It's absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what's fascinating to me about those scenarios. You know, we just have different ways. We have probably we have probably more subtle ways and obviously not so subtle ways of living that out, and probably in a way that we sort of design so that people can't see it as clearly, you know, in our lives.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, or we only really show it to a couple of people.
That's it, like, right there. Yeah, that's it right there.
Yeah, maybe our wife and our agent, you know, like they hear about it, but otherwise people, I mean, you get adept at playing the game, right?
Yeah.
You get adept at, like, I don't know, in some ways just being an adult, but also in other ways just kind of giving people what they want in a certain moment. But at the end of the day, if you care about the craft, whether it's writing or music or making food or whatever, you have a vision for how you want to do it, right? And I think you and I, in our own spheres of life, we admire the craftsman, right?
Yeah.
But then getting older, I don't know, I think the greatest thing about getting older is, and Ralph Fiennes' character goes through this in the movie, the greatest thing about getting older is you have a really clear picture of the impact that the work is going to have.
Right.
And it's not some glum, fatalistic, this doesn't matter thing, but it kind of is, in the sense that even if I write some great book, it's going to have like a 3-month shelf life. And then in 3 months, nobody's going to care about it because they will have moved on to something else.
Yeah.
And it's like, I still want to make a great book. You know what I mean? I still want the book to be awesome, but I don't have these, you know, outlandish fantasies about what it's going to do or not do. And I actually think that's a gift.
Yeah.
And it can allow you to take an imperfect project. You know what I mean? You can say yes to the project that's going to put food on your table or allow you to travel to a cool place and might otherwise just be stupid or banal or whatever. But you can kind of say yes to it, and you can go, it's an opportunity to write. It's an opportunity to provide. I'm not going to be like way up my own backside over it artistically, because that's insufferable in its own way.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of freeing at some level. But I again, though, for me, and I think for you too, probably, like, those things come with the gospel. Like, those things come with walking closely with the Lord.
Yeah.
I could have never gotten there on my own. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, all that's a really good perspective, man. It's just, I think it's hard because there's, you know, you're serious about, you know, whatever your art is, writing, music, you know, whatever it is, like, you're serious about it, and you make it, if you have any intention on making it on a commercial level, which means, you know, you're working with either a record label or a book publisher because they are going to put time and money into it, they're going to promote it. Like, so there's, you know, there's a part of you that wants as many people as possible to enjoy the work, right? Because that's partly why you're creating it, is because you want an audience to gain some level of enjoyment on whatever mm-hmm. level from it. So
yeah.
I think what's hard is that you get to a place, hopefully, you know, later in your life, if you're still creating things, that you realize, look, I can't control that part of it. And I think that's one of the frustrating things about any artist, is that I can't control, like, who is actually going to, like, get a piece of this art and enjoy it. I can't control how many people are going to do it. And by the way, it never comes down to the quality of the project. That's never been the case. It comes down to all kinds of weird things, and word of mouth and better distribution just things hitting at a certain time. Other people that have a bigger influence in you grabbing a hold of things, and them telling people about it, which gains you a wider audience. There is literally 1,001 things that can gain you a wider audience, and you literally have nothing to do with almost any of it. And so you kind of just go, okay, so I guess at the end of the day, then, as an artist, I'm just like every other artist. It's just some artists, they step into those, I'm going to use this word even though I don't believe this, but they're going to step into sort of these dumb luck kind of situations and circumstances, which allowed their project to go wider than maybe one of my projects did. And there's just nothing I can do about that. So therefore, it goes back to what you said, T. Like, I make the work because I want to do it for myself. I think it's valuable as a work of art. And I don't want to be pretentious about it. I want to enjoy the process. Yeah. And if the Lord if the Lord creates a wider audience for it, great. If he doesn't, great. But like, I just don't have any control over that.
Yeah, no, that's well said, because I mean, if you and I had a nickel for every sort of bitter artist we've encountered in middle age, you know, and to be fair, I ran the risk of becoming that person, yeah. But for the Lord, like, I mean, the streets are lined with people like that, you know, like, musicians, writers, whatever. And you gotta, you know, I want to live in a world where even if I'm not rich and famous, I still really enjoy doing the work.
Yeah, 100%.
You know?
Yep.
If I came to a place later in life where I hated writing, gosh, that'd be tragic. You know,
well,
really sad.
It's sad. And what's so funny about it too is that, you know, we all aspire to be what we all aspire to, the 1%, yeah. The magic 1% of artists who gain a platform that like gave them, you know, a lifestyle and an income that is far beyond anything, you know, we will ever experience. And so it's like, dude, there's a reason why only 1% like get to that place, because it's rarefied air.
That's right.
And I mean, so it's like, so I hate that I'm so average that I couldn't, I hate that I'm so average, number one. And number two, the breaks didn't come my way to where I gained millions and millions and millions of fans. But at the same time, it's like, well, I'm also a believer, which means there's a reason why the Lord said, yeah, I'm not going to have that for you. That's not for you.
I mean, he probably knew what it would do to us, you know, and it would have turned us into monsters, I'm sure.
Yeah, 100%.
Even if not in over the top obvious ways, in like very subtle ways, it would have, as it does for most people.
Yeah, for sure.
Baby, we are going to have to worry about that just because of the money and the fame and the decadence that this program brings us.
I mean, 100%. It's not even debatable.
You know,
it's not even.
Yeah, we're talking like this is theoretical. This
is not theoretical. It's 100% true. It's just we're just waiting for the moment.
Yeah, dude. You know what? Can I share a petty, like, catty thing, and then I'm going to wrap the show because we've already gone
way too long.
We're getting
long.
Time and a half right now.
Way too
we've
long.
We've gone 10 minutes longer than we intended to.
Yeah, share it.
I never drop in the third ad break, and I do it just to kind of poke at the media conglomerate that we're signed to.
Yeah. I didn't know we were supposed to have three ad breaks. So now you're...
We are, dude, and I do it as kind of a commentary.
All right.
You know? It feels good to get that off my chest, but listeners, you will get a third ad break at some point, and they'll just drop it right in there. You'll be listening like mid-sentence.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
You know, we'll be sharing our hearts with you, and you'll get an ad for like, I don't know, HelloFresh or whatever. But
oh man, I love that! Can we ask Barnabas to title this episode "The Third Ad Break"?
The third ad break, dude. I love it. Yeah, because we're coming clean about some things right now.
Yeah,
vis-a-vis how we do business here at
Rant. Just being honest. That's right.
Yeah, just being honest, just being vulnerable, just opening up the old heart a little bit. You know, you've seen behind the curtain this morning, listeners. Thank you for listening. As always, we have done what we always do. And until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
What do you do when your world is falling apart? How do you march when it would be easier to stay where you are and die? Join me every week on the March or Die podcast, and we'll discuss that and so much more.